I'd like to talk a little bit this evening about one of the core teachings of Buddhism, is the Noble Eightfold Path. This is, if anything, perhaps the most important, most central of the Buddhist teachings, and that the Buddha described in his first sermon as the middle way. Middle way that doesn't go anywhere near the two extremes. And I think one of the reasons why I thought to talk about this evening is because this notion of the middle way, actually, when we're doing our spiritual practice, very often what we actually do is just spend most of our time bouncing around between the extremes, going from one side to another, not quite knowing what we're doing, and avoiding the middle way at all costs. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm just speaking for myself here. And sometimes it seems that there's this kind of force in the mind or tendency in the mind that wants to do what we know is silly. And we know what we know is painful, we know is going to cause us harm, and we know what's going to cause harm for others as well, and yet we still do it. It's crazy, isn't it? And so some people say the definition of craziness is to keep doing the same thing and expect to get different results. But that's what we do all the time, every one of us, every day. We keep doing the same thing and expect to get different results. So that's why the Buddha pointed to the power of ignorance or power of delusion, which is such a force that shapes our lives, shapes our minds in ways that are very profound. And of course we can't know how our minds are being shaped by delusion, because we're deluded about it. That's what it is. Delusion is precisely the not knowing about what's happening. And so the more that we think we know, usually the less that we actually know. The Buddha said, yena yena hi manyanti tatotam hoti anyata. Whatever you think it is, it always turns out to be something else. Whatever you think it is, actually it's something else. So when we talk about the middle way, there's something about the middleness of the middle way which you can kind of we can have an idea about it, but there's something about the experience of it which somehow the mind responds to. Somehow you hit that sweet spot. And you know, and that's there's a sense or a quality that middle way has, which you learn to recognize. It's like a sense of understanding. So on one level we can do our Buddhist practice through studying the teachings and through trying to put them into practice, but at another level we also try to kind of intuit that middle way, trying to get some kind of almost like an instinct, a gut feeling of what the right thing to do is. And so that actually those two attitudes, those two aspects of middle way is another aspect of the two extremes. One extreme is to just have an entirely theoretical or intellectual approach to it, okay, where it's just you're studying about the middle way, studying about the teachings and not actually practicing anything. And another extreme is to just entirely, you know, like kind of trust the force loop kind of thing, where you don't have to actually learn anything and you just trust your feelings and that's it. Yeah? Because your feelings are also deluded. So feelings are sometimes trustworthy and sometimes not. So practice has to be a balance of those things. So wherever we look, we always find these tendencies which are pulling us away from the middle way. So when we look at the Eightfold Path itself, then these eight factors, which you should all know off by heart, in Pali, together with the analysis and details of them, right? And if you don't, you're slack, and you're not a good Buddhist. It's a bit judgmental, isn't it? But anyway. No, but seriously, it's very important teaching, yeah? So it's something that you should take the time to study and to learn. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And they all have a certain content. Each one of these factors has a certain content, and it's described in the suttas. When the Buddha taught, he would give each of these factors a succinct and clear definition. Right. So on the one hand, you have each of these things taught with a succinct and clear definition, which is useful to learn off by heart, so you know what that is. But also, he also talked about these things in many different ways and different aspects at different times and places. So there's also a richness and a complexity and a nuance about it as well. So we have on the one hand a very clear sort of set of doctrines, but we also have a richness in terms of how those are applied in different contexts and different times and places. The first one of that is right view, samadhi. So right view is the understanding, the ideas, the opinions that you have. And to practice a right view, in some way we have to undertake the practice of correcting our ideas. Okay? And to correct our ideas means we have to engage with them. Okay? It takes work, it takes effort. Right? But effort actually is another one of the factors. Yeah? Right effort is another one of the factors. So right effort actually goes along with all of them. These things are not separated. Right? So if we want to improve our right view, improve our understanding, we have to use the right effort. We also have to use our mindfulness. That goes along with it as well. So to improve a right view, we have to learn to think clearly. Right? We have to learn what's correct reasoning, what's incorrect, what's fallacious logic. We have to learn what's to be able to test things according to evidence. We have to study the Buddhist scriptures, study the way that the teachings are explained in different contexts. We have to ask questions about those things that we are unclear about, discuss things, have conversations about them, learn to articulate our ideas. Yeah? It's one of the most powerful ways of clarifying our right view is to talk about them, yeah? To be able to articulate it. Because when we try to articulate them, you should try doing my job once in a while, all right? You should try sitting in front of a bunch of people and actually explaining the Dhamma, yeah? And then you realize it's not as easy as it looks, yeah? And to clearly explain and articulate a subtle matter like the Dhamma, if something's very hard. This is why, of course, it takes a Sammasambuddha to really do it properly. And we can come along and learn from what he's done. And so we've got all that precedent and everything, so it's much easier for us. But still, to be able to articulate it, and that's something actually I learned from my history teacher in high school. He was a very learned Christian brother, Kevin Paul, his name was, and he always used to say that if you can't explain something, you don't really understand it. And I think that there's some truth to that, yeah? Okay, maybe there are some things which are too subtle or too personal to be able to explain properly, but as a general principle, I think that there's probably a lot of truth to that. We understand things in a very kind of vague sense. But to actually communicate that understanding to another is also very, very useful. It's a part of that clarifying right view. So thank you, Nilushi, for that lesson in impermanence. So when the Buddha described right view, the most basic definition of right view is Four Noble Truths. Okay? Suffering, origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the way of practice leading to the ending of suffering, which is none other than the Eightfold Path itself. Right, so the Eightfold Path is part of understanding right view. Right view is part of the Eightfold Path, and the Eightfold Path is part of right view. See, the Buddha didn't have to deal with mobile phones, you see? Yeah. Yeah, so these things are not separate. What that means is that the study and the practice of Buddhism are not two separate things. Yeah, the theory, understanding of Buddhism, and the way we practice, they're not separate things. They're part of each other. They have to inform each other all the time, otherwise we get lost. So the basic understanding of right view is in terms of the Four Noble Truths. Right? And in a sense, again, just at a basic or an initial level, that's something which I think is reflectively sort of fairly clear and fairly straightforward. Yeah, I mean, the Four Noble Truths obviously are a very profound teaching. But just at a basic level, the Four Noble Truths are saying, look, we have suffering in our life. The important aspects of that suffering are things that are our own responsibility, that come from our own choices, our own desires and delusions and so on. And there's something we can do about that. Yeah? there's something we can do about it because we can influence and we can condition, we can train ourselves. Right? That's the path. That's essentially what the Four Noble Truths are saying at a basic level, and I think that most of us can understand that. Yeah. So maybe some people can't. So I think if, for example, if you're emotionally totally dependent on the idea that you're going to be saved by a savior, by someone else, right? Then you're not ready even for that initial understanding of the Four Noble Truths, right? If you're thinking, you know, God is going to come along and save me and there's nothing I can do, but give myself up to God, that's not the Four Noble Truths. So you haven't really even started the beginning of that path. Or else if you're just intent on blaming everyone, yeah? It's Kevin Rudd's to blame. Yeah, it's the politicians, it's the economies to blame, it's my childhood trauma is to blame, or whatever, yeah? Then you're not taking responsibility. Yeah? And so again, even that basic level of the Four Noble Truths is not really there yet. So as well as that understanding of right view in terms of the Four Noble Truths, because there's many different aspects to right view, many different ways of explaining it, and many ways of looking at it. Another way of looking at right view that the Buddha talked about was in the idea of karma. And so understanding of karma was also an explanation of right view, that there's cause and effect. So what this is essentially saying, again, on the most basic level, is that our moral choices have consequences. Okay? Our choices have consequences. And you can't escape this. Again, if you can't accept that, if you think that you can do harmful acts and get away with it, right? If you can think you can fob off the consequences on someone else, yeah? Or if you're in denial about the fact that there is actually good and bad, then you haven't got this first factor of right view, even at a very basic level. So these are some of the things that the Buddha was pointing to in his right view. And so you can see that if you don't have those kinds of understanding, you really can't even get going in your Buddhist practice. Yeah? Until you're actually prepared to accept some responsibility yourself for your choices, then you're getting nowhere in the Buddhist path. Right? So this is why this right view is at the beginning. And so it's not saying that we have to all become sort of experts in Buddhist doctrine or Abhidhamma or dependent origination or anything like that. It's saying that we have to have this understanding within ourselves that we are responsible, ultimately, for our own moral and spiritual development, for our own happiness. That we've created the situation that we're in and that we can do something about it. Yeah. So this is why this factor of right view is right at the start of the Eightfold Path. Now, it's not here, in a sense, the right view is like an understanding or a wisdom, okay? But it's not a wisdom necessarily which is very well developed yet. It doesn't mean that you've got all the answers, okay? It just means that you're willing to accept that this path is something that needs to be developed. So when we have that, when we have that acceptance of that moral responsibility, then that the second aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path comes into play, which is right intention, sammasankappa. And what sammasankappa is it's like the direction of the mind. And so again, it's given a very kind of handy definition, thoughts or intentions of renunciation of non-ill will and non-harming. Okay, so these are the three kinds of sammasankappa, right? Sankappa, generally speaking, means thought or intention, something like that. But you can see from the definition of it, it doesn't mean thought in an intellectual sense. Okay, so the samadhi, the right view, is more the intellectual component of things. Sammasankappa is actually more emotional. Yeah, so that feeling of letting go is more an emotional thing, or that like non-harming and non-ill will. And of course the positive sides of that is like compassion and loving kindness and so on, generosity and all of these kinds of things. So these are more the heart qualities which are informing the right view. And so again, this is very important, because if the right view remains merely intellectual, it's just right theory, okay, then it's only addressing a part of who we are. It's only partial. Let's not say it's wrong, but it's only partial. And sometimes in Buddhism, Buddhists can be very dismissive of intellectual study of the Dhamma. You know, it's only theory, it's only study, and so on and so forth. And that's being small-minded. And in a sense, it's also usually a sign of laziness. People usually dismiss textual study because they can't be bothered doing it themselves. Right? So rather than actually doing it, it's easier to criticize others who are doing it. In fact, where would we be without it? Yeah? Where would we be without, say, the scholars of the Pali Text Society in England who were academics and they weren't necessarily even Buddhists, and yet they gave years and years and years of their lives to editing, translating, and publishing the Buddhist texts, which have really formed the foundation of our modern understanding of Buddhism. So we owe a tremendous amount, tremendous debt to these people, and that's just one example. The same thing's happened every generation through time, that these texts, these teachings have been passed down. Not everyone who's passed them down has actually practiced them. Yeah? But that still doesn't mean we shouldn't be grateful for them. It's not complete. To have just an intellectual approach to Dhamma, it's not complete, but it's not wrong, right? It's just something that's needed further growth and further development, that's all. And so that further growth and further development comes through the right intention, yeah? So that bringing those qualities of loving kindness, of compassion, of letting go into the direction of where we want to use our mind. Sankhapa is an active force, right? It's not just a passive thing, it's an active force, it's where we're moving towards. For me, this is very important in terms of even like the way of life I've chosen as a monk and so on. And I've always been very uncomfortable with capitalism, for example. I'm very uncomfortable with the idea of going and earning money, you know. And for a job, even when I was a musician and so on, I used to hate it, you know. I used to prefer to just go and play my guitar on the street corner. This is just something I've inherent in who I was. I never tried to be a big pop star so I could make lots of money. I think it's revolting, you know. But I love to stand on the street corner and just sing songs and have people, you know, put a 20-cent coin in the guitar case, you know. And to me, that's what I really loved. And so for me, that's why the monk's life is such a wonderful thing, because it enables me to try to put these things into practice in a very holistic way, not just a partial way. I'm not having to sort of buy into this system of competition and backbiting and everything which often goes on in the workplace. But really trying to live a whole life in that direction where everything that you do is trying to work through these things of renunciation, yeah? So not just for me giving up and renouncing a lot of things myself, but also encouraging, supporting others to take that life, but also supporting, you know, many people who do, say, volunteer work. So the people who help in organizing the evenings that you come along, the people who are helping in all the kinds of different projects and fundraising and so on that we do through Santi and that we also support in other organizations. All this is helping encourage this nekama sankhapa, is that intention towards letting go, intention towards giving up. It's all part of the Eightfold Path. And the loving kindness and the compassion. So these are things which should inform that whole direction of our life. Yeah? What are we doing with our life? How are we choosing to live? How are we choosing to relate to people? When you meet somebody, is that person are they just someone that you can make money out of? I remember this story that my good friend Giles told me one time, that when he was a young man just looking for his first job, one of the first jobs that he applied for was in an insurance company and selling insurance. And he had the job interview, and the guy who's doing the interview said to him, just at the end of the interview, it all finished and everything was going well, everything was good. And at the end of the interview, the last thing he said to him was, "Oh, by the way, do you belong to any sports clubs?" And Giles said, "Oh, yeah, I belong to a, you know, football club, or I play cricket or something like that." And just as he said that, it sort of clicked to him. oh, I'm never going to have any friends if I take this job. Everyone in my club, everyone in my friends is going to be a potential buyer of this insurance. Yeah? And as soon as I meet them, I'm going to be thinking, oh, you know, how can I sell them some insurance? And that's how my life's going to go. And so he could see this kind of dark side opening up, you know, in front of him, ready to pull him into it. And so he just sort of really pulled back. And so that's, and then he went, you know, chose a different course in life, and he's gone into nursing and psych nursing and things like that, into sort of a direction of life where he could do things that were really helpful and useful for people. Yeah. So that's that samasankappa. How are we going to direct our mind? We have that understanding of the Dhamma. Where are we going to move our mind? How are we going to direct our mind that's going to be the most beneficial? Now, the way that manifests most obviously is in terms of the external behavior, right speech, right action, right livelihood, you know, the next three factors, yeah? And right speech, of course, is very directly related to our intentions, because if we have motivation or feeling of anger, then angry words come out, yeah? And so on. So we can see that's a very obvious relationship there. So these three factors are to do with our bodily conduct, with our behavior, what we call the sila. And so right speech, of course, again, has a very simple definition in terms of not using false speech, not using divisive speech, not using harsh speech, and not using kind of meaningless speech. So speech should always be true. It should be leading towards harmony, and it should be meaningful. It should be kind. These are the factors of right speech. So it's very, very important to remember that this is also absolutely essential in our practice. I often find that there's this kind of a sort of escapist tendency in Buddhist practitioners to somehow want to have, they don't want to speak. They want to try to avoid it. So right speech is like avoiding speaking. So to say nothing. And so we have this very kind of passive, there's a very passive tendency in a lot of Buddhist cultures. And it's I find that very unhealthy. Yeah, it actually comes from a lack of courage, a lot of the time. Yeah, a lack of just being too scared to say what you really think because of the consequences, especially if you think someone might be getting upset. Yeah, the Buddha would say things that would get people upset. Yeah, he didn't say it in order to make them upset. Well, maybe once or twice, but generally speaking. You know, he would use his speech in a way that was very skillful and that wouldn't get people upset. But sometimes he would, yeah, when they needed it. Yeah, sometimes people need to be told off. They need to get a good scolding. Sometimes people are very arrogant and they need to have their kind of arrogance pricked or something like that. So sometimes it's okay to use your speech in that kind of way, but only in a limited sense. Yeah, not as a general tendency, only in specific cases and only in a very gentle way. So it's very important that as Buddhists, or just as people who are interested in a spiritual path, that we learn to articulate our views and to state them in a way that's clear, that's respectful, and which encourages an intelligent dialogue. Yeah? If we become Buddhists and we become completely silent all the time, you know, who is going to be speaking? Yeah? There's lots of people speaking in the world, right? If it's not us, who is it? Yeah. If it's not the people who are interested in spiritual practice, then it's all the ones who are not interested in spiritual practice. Yeah? And so that, because then the tone of the conversation will always go down. So it's from a part of our Buddhist practice is to learn how to articulate and use our speech in the right way. And so this is how we try to create not just wisdom within ourselves, but also a culture of wisdom, and to spread that and to share that around us. We shouldn't be ashamed of it. We shouldn't be afraid of it. Buddhism is an incredibly beautiful teaching. Yeah? Well, the things that the Buddha said have been unsurpassed in human history. Maybe somebody will do something better one day, I don't know, but certainly I don't think up to now that they have done. So we should never feel embarrassed or ashamed to put the Buddhist point of view into a conversation, yeah? And to represent that clearly and fairly. So this is a practice of right speech, right action, of course, not to kill, steal, and commit sexual misconduct, the basic precepts. But more generally also refers to just our behavior generally. So trying to act in a way that causes benefit for people. And remembering that keeping the precepts isn't just about not hurting. They aren't just negative things. So practicing this Eightfold Path is more than just not hurt, for example, not hurting living beings, right? So we can think that we're good Buddhists because maybe we don't kill ants or something like that, yeah? But actually, there's more to be done, yeah? To really develop that practice, there's more to be done than that. We should be, for example, the Buddha said in keeping this precept that one is filled with compassion for the welfare of all live sentient beings, yeah? It's not just not killing them, but to be filled with compassion for the welfare of all sentient beings. And that is something that's not just an internal feeling, but that manifests in action. Okay? And how do we actually act in the world? What are we doing about the animals in the world who are suffering? You know, what are we doing about the people in the world who are suffering? What are we doing about... I keep on seeing sins in there and keep on thinking about elephants. Whether there are four elephants in the world that are suffering or the fish in the world that are suffering. Yeah, what are we actually? Are we doing anything about these things? Yeah, are we actually manifesting our supposed Buddhist compassion in realistic and effective action in the world? Yeah, what about the poor people? What about the sick? What about the dying? All of these things, we should all be concerned with them, and we should all try to be able to do what we can as part of this right action in the Noble Eightfold Path. And then, of course, right livelihood. I mentioned a little bit about that before, but to me, right livelihood means that I think we should try to live our lives or make a living in a way that that manifestly creates some good. So, of course, right livelihood, like all these factors of the Eightfold Path, has its sort of simple definition, not to you know, trade in animals, not to trade in drugs, not to trade in weapons, and so on. So these are the kinds of wrong livelihood. Yeah, but there's more to that. When we're actually working, or what we're doing with our life, are we doing something that's actually meaningfully helping people? And I think this is something where, in modern society, we've become so cut off from things because it's our work has become so fragmented. You know, I always remember that Henry Ford described his production line when he was making the Model T Ford, and he made this description, and he said, like, I can employ, like, you know, 60 blind men and 60, you know, 50 one-armed men and 30 people without any legs, and we went through this whole kind of list. Because each job on the production line was so specific that it didn't actually require a whole person anymore. It only required one limb, right? Yeah. And of course now, it's progressed to, well, that's all done by robots now, isn't it? You don't even have to have humans, yeah? So the robots can just do it all. But that's how our lives are, and a lot of us are in jobs where, especially if we're in service industries or like administration jobs and these kinds of things, where you're completely cut off from the kind of the actual reality of what's been created. You think about traditional lifestyles, where if you were, say, being a farmer is a very boring and hard job, okay? I don't know if you've ever, has anyone here ever done it, farming? Yeah? I've done a little bit for just a few weeks when I was staying in Malaysia one time. And it's hard work, you know. It's not something that you want to you get excited about. But it's incredibly thrilling to actually plant something in the ground and then have it come up and then eat it. And to have that and to share that with other people, yeah? And to think, wow, this is amazing, this thing here, which was just nothing. It was just a seed, we put it in the dirt, we've now taken that up, we've cooked it. And we're now sharing it among our friends and family here, and we're all eating this. And that's an incredibly meaningful experience. And, you know, that's something which is a common human experience, yeah? The vast majority of people in time have all had that experience. And we've now completely lost it. Yeah, we've got no conception of what that feels like. So how do we actually create that sense of meaning in what we're doing? That actually something is happening. And, you know, even some, you know, simple job, simple kinds of work, you can do that. For example, like a builder. And one of the things I have to do at my monastery is build things. And you can see that the contractors and so on who come along and do things, they have a sense of pride in their work. You know, you get a sense of accomplishment that you can actually make, you know, you put the plumbing into a bathroom or whatever, you know, you do, and it's there, you know, people can use it. And so there's a sense of there's an accomplishment there. But so many of our jobs, it's very difficult to see that. So this is what I'd like to sort of encourage and think is a really good way of practicing right livelihood, is to practice something where you can actually tangibly see something that's beneficial for people. So, and then that, so that's, then the other last three factors of the Eightfold Path is the right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. And I won't go too much in detail into these. These are mainly the meditative portions of the path. And right effort, of course, is being the effort to abandon the unwholesome and to develop the wholesome, basically. Okay. So one thing about right effort is right effort doesn't mean kind of forcing yourself or doing anything that's extreme. But right effort is much more about consistency. Yeah? It's like a consistent understanding and a consistent ability to abandon what's wholesome and develop what's wholesome. If you can do that one by one, each time, then that's the right effort. And the next factor, right mindfulness, is more specifically to do with meditation. So, yes, of course, it's true we should be trying to be mindful all the time and so on, but the right mindfulness itself as a factor is mainly focusing on the meditative and contemplative dimension of the path. So this is where we're starting to move from the everyday practices, which we've been talking about up to now, towards something that's much more specialized and much more refined, and bringing that refined sense of awareness to watching the breath coming in, the breath going out, breath coming in. And seeing that, watching that, having that sense of awareness, that sense of that sense of peace, that sense of joy, and that sense of unification that comes from that application of mindfulness in meditation. So this is really what that factor of right mindfulness is about. And if we're able to do that correctly, then that of course leads to the last factor of the path, which is right samadhi. And right samadhi is of course always defined as the four jhanas. So this is very subtle states of unification of consciousness. Mind withdraws from the five senses. It's absorbed into an inner experience of a purified and radiant consciousness. So this is where this Eightfold Path is starting to get very, very kind of exalted. Yeah? The Eightfold Path is not something that's simple. If it was simple or basic, then it wouldn't be leading to enlightenment. So that Samma Samadhi, that right Samadhi, when the mind is unified and bright and clear like that, all of those other factors of the Eightfold Path are coming together. Okay, everything else that we've done leading up to that, it manifests or it sort of yields its fruits in that state of consciousness. And especially when emerging from that state, that the right view, which we develop right at the start of the practice, will then become much, much deeper. And so our initial understanding, our opinion or idea about the Four Noble Truths and dependent origination and so on will then become an intuitive insight, an intuitive understanding. And so that means that when we experience that sense of refined consciousness, see, normally what would happen, if we don't have right view, if we don't start out with right view, and we practice meditation, we'll experience a state of samadhi, a state of purified consciousness, and we'll go, wow, that's it. And then you can put the dotted lines and you can put on whatever the dotted lines you think it is. That's God, or that's the ultimate, or that's Krishna, or that's whatever it is. And you read some kind of name into that thing and you attach to that. Whereas a Buddhist practitioner will say, oh, that was a state of consciousness. That was a state of samadhi, yeah? Now it's gone. That's impermanent, okay? It was there, now it's not. Ah, so this is where that understanding of the Four Noble Truths is coming in. Oh, that was impermanent, yeah? Because it's impermanent, it's never completely satisfactory. Because it's never completely satisfactory, it can't be a self or a soul. It can't be anything which is a permanent and stable identity. And so then there's the insight starts to be born and starts to emerge from that experience. And so that is the insight which leads to liberation. So this is how the Eightfold Path actually is extended in some of the teachings to a tenfold path, where after the right samadhi, you then have some samanyana, is the right insight, and some vimutti, is the right liberation. Okay, so that's like the full thing, is actually 10 factors rather than just 8. So if you thought it was difficult to memorize the 8 factors, well, then you've got another 2 to memorize. And I think the most important thing, if you only remember one thing from this evening's talk, the most important thing is to remember that each of these factors has its own special role to play, and none of them can be left out. And we can't replace one factor with another factor. Okay, so you can't have a fault in your speech and think, I'm going to do some meditation and I'm going to fix that up. You can't have mistaken understanding, okay, and then think that can be solved through another path factor. Okay, each factor has to be fixed in its own domain. Okay, our wrong understanding has to be fixed with right view. Our wrong intentions have to be fixed with right intentions. Our wrong speech has to be fixed with right speech. Okay, so each one has its own domain. It each works with a different aspect of our mind in its own different way. So all of these put together is that holistic way of practice, which is what leads to the results. So that's my little talk for you this evening on the Noble Eightfold Path. So I offer this to you for your reflection. And I'd like to invite any comments or questions.
The Rupa states, are they classified as Samasati as well?
They're, well, I think they're more like the optional extras. You know, it's like that's like the kind of the extra CD player or something in the car. The car still gets where it's going, but maybe a bit more pleasantly. I think they're not included in the standard definition of the Eightfold Path, and I think the reason why that is because, in a sense, they're optional. So some people won't develop them. So the Eightfold Path is more like the minimum requirements for liberation. And the Arupa, the formless attainments, are obviously useful for some people, but not required for everyone. Yeah. What are they? Oh, okay, so the question was about the Arupa, or the formless attainments. And in the Buddhist system of classifying meditation states, the main classification you have, of course, the four jhanas, yeah? And the four jhanas are sometimes called the rupa, or like the form jhanas. And the reason they're called rupa is because they're based on an experience which is in some way derived from a material or physical experience, which in meditation we see as a nimitta. Okay, so you see a light, for example. So a light is rupa. That's what it's called in Pali, rupa. So it's a form. And it's in some way it's related to or similar to a physical or material phenomenon. Okay? So if you see a light in your meditation, it looks exactly like a light, right? So much so that you can actually mistakenly think that someone's turned the lights on in the room, and you open your eyes and you realize, oh no, it's actually still completely dark. It's only light in here, and then you close your eyes again, and then you realize it's now dark inside as well because you've destroyed your meditation. But that's how it really is, just like a light, right? And that's what's called rupa, and those first four jhanas are based on that rupa, which is that experience of the light. Now, the teachings of the four arupa is basically what happens when the mind becomes so subtle that it lets go even of that very, very subtle reflection of a light or an image in the mind. Okay, and so the way that it's described in the suttas, it really just mentions their names. There's a few bits and pieces, but very little description of them. Is the base of infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and neither perception nor non-perception, right? And the way that that's described in the commentary is that when you fully develop the first four jhanas, okay, you've developed where that rupa or that sense of form or that light is immeasurable, okay. So rather than being a limited light which is just in one place in consciousness, it actually fills the whole of your consciousness. So it's like an infinite light, all right? Then when the mind wants to become even more subtle, it drops that, and even that light disappears. And so you're just aware of the space where that light was. Okay, so that's the first formless attainment. It's the base of infinite space. Yeah? But then being aware of infinite space in itself becomes too coarse. And mind wants to become too subtle, and so it becomes aware of the consciousness of that space, which is the base of infinite consciousness, right? But then even that becomes too coarse, right? You're like, you're sitting there, you're like, God, this infinite consciousness business, it gets really boring after a while. I wish my mind could just be nothing. And so you're aware, instead of being aware of the infinite consciousness, then the mind just drops that and is aware of nothingness. The space that's left when you're no longer aware of infinite consciousness is the awareness of nothingness. But that's still a perception, yeah? And so then the mind again wants to drop that, so the mind is going more and more and more towards subtlety. So it goes into this place where it's not even really perceiving anything, but it's not quite not perceiving anything either, yeah? So it's called the base of neither perception nor non-perception. That's the fourth of the formless attainments. So basically, it's just his mind's continually dropping off things which are like more and more refined, and is leaving less and less and less behind. So that the formless attainment. And so that's one path that the Buddha said, you know, you can practice to realize Nibbana. And even though not everyone will do it, even not all arahants will have access to those attainments, but for those who do, then that can be very powerful.
What's beyond that?
Well, then there's the attainment of cessation. Yeah.
But then, are you saying that, so even if someone's enlightened, they may not have attained the arupa state?
That's right, yeah.
But they would have to have attained the jhanas.
Yeah, at least some of them. Yeah.
Right.
Hmm. I mean, if you look at what the suttas say, is that you can basically there's plenty of examples where the suttas say you know somebody say enters into first jhana and then develops the insight into that this is impermanent suffering, it's not self, and then they can get liberation. Right? But the suttas also say that, and this is stated very quite explicitly in the Anguttara Tens, that basically all arahants will have access to the fourth jhana. So they'll be able to realize the fourth jhana. So even if you hadn't practiced the fourth jhana beforehand, then you can, before becoming an arahant, then you can afterwards. And which makes sense, is because you haven't got any hindrances in your mind. What's there to stop you from realizing jhana? So,
Sante, is there a good reason why the aspects of the Eightfold Path are in particular order?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, right views.
Right.
First, but the other one following a particular order. finishing with mindfulness and samadhi.
Yeah, that's right.
Why is mindfulness and samadhi at the end?
Oh, because they're the most refined.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is that indicating that it's important to work on these other aspects before?
Yeah.
Mindfulness and samadhi, or?
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
So as you were saying, if you just focus on samadhi and not worry about the other things, you can get deluded.
You can get very deluded, yeah. And if that happens, what you tend to find is you get a lot of overestimation. People will tend to think that they've gone a lot further than they have. But you also find that say, especially if people are doing meditation retreats, that people will have very unstable experiences. So you can have an experience, you know, good experience of samadhi or concentration in a retreat, and then it'll completely fall apart afterwards. And so there's not like a long-term sense of spiritual development. But also you can get various kinds of, I mean, those kinds of things are, in a sense, merely drawbacks, but you can also get more dangerous things where it's actually, you know, the mind can become unstable because of going too far too fast. Yeah. So, yeah, always definitely.
First thing to think about when you come to Buddhism is meditation.
Yeah.
That's just stress, the natural fact you're playing it down.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They should proceed, but there's
incorporated in an early stage before. Because that seems to be downplayed quite a bit in popular Buddhism. You know, meditation is really what's harder.
Yeah. There's a linear aspect, but there's also like a cyclic aspect as well. It's not a completely linear thing. It's not that you just do right view and then that's finished and gone. But there is a tendency where there is a linear dimension to it, which is just a matter of evolution or development. You know, that's how we do develop. We change over time. You know, you're quite right that tends to be a bit backwards when it's presented, especially in the West. In traditional Buddhism, it's more the opposite problem, which is that meditation isn't talked about at all, and only the you know, in traditional Buddhist practices, teachings, it's only dana, generosity, and maybe five precepts, and that's about as far as it gets most of the time. So that's kind of the opposite extreme. The reason why meditation is stressed so much is really sort of a characteristic of the way Buddhism's developed in the West. One of the things is because we're just interested in it. I mean, if you come along, you know, try to teach, say, I'm here to teach a religion, and the first thing I want to do is tell you what to do and what not to do, then, well, no one's going to be that interested. We've kind of got sick of religions that are going to go around preaching to us, you know, so... But whereas meditation and altered states of consciousness and so on is very fascinating. So in a way, that's just something that draws us into it. But it's also the case that the teachings on meditation are perhaps more distinctive of Buddhism and more the things that Buddhism has to offer which are not already found and taught well. You know, I mean, I think the teachings on ethics and things are... There's plenty of people teaching good ethics... You know, don't have to be Buddhism to teach those things, but the meditation is something that's much more specialised.
A lot of the meditation seems to be co-opted in, you know, relaxation.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and there's much more talk of mindfulness.
Yeah. The
danger is Buddhism sort of losing. That's how a lot of people approach meditation, relaxation.
Yeah.
See it as being a full package, you know.
That's not a... I don't see that as a problem at all. That's just a developmental thing.
It can be a way in. You start off...
Exactly.
...with relaxation, and you read a bit more about it.
And for some people, maybe that's all they want.
Yeah.
You know, you can't sort of force people to become a dedicated Buddhist practitioner just because you think it's good for them.
No.
For some people, they can find 10 minutes doing some breathing exercises and they feel happier, and terrific, you know, there's no problem with that. But, you know, one of the things that I have found, because I'm doing this course on Buddhism and psychotherapy, and most of the people on the course are, or all of the people on the course are therapists of one form or another, and most of them are there precisely for that reason. They're there because they've become interested in Buddhism, because it offers some therapeutic help in terms of a mindfulness training or something like that. But now they're finding that they want to really understand more about Buddhism and more about the Dhamma so they can have more of a sense of how does it fit in their life. It's not just a therapeutic technique which is useful to help certain people with certain kinds of conditions, but something which actually gives a sense of meaning and context for their lives as a whole.
Yeah. I remember reading something of Patrick Carney said. He said that in the West we see a form of Buddhized psychology emerging.
Yeah.
And he said, but ultimately, in the end, we have to choose if we're going to follow Buddha or follow Freud, because they're heading in different directions. You know, it was a short quote. It was taken in context, but my thoughts were, and I was sort of these self-help books that come out with a little out of context quote of what Buddha said about this. But you know, if you read the whole sutra, it's sort of people sort of are picking bits and pieces out. And incorporating other techniques and things from other belief systems into these, you know, new forms and new systems. And I think it's sort of, you know, in some ways it can be corrupting the Dharma or sharing a wrong view.
Well, it can be, but it doesn't have to be. It depends whether it's discernment. Because the Buddha did it. And this is one thing that you know, if you've got any kind of historical knowledge, the Buddha was constantly doing exactly the same thing, taking bits and pieces from here and there. Somebody would bring in a Jaina practice or a Brahmanical practice or something like that, and he'd quite happily adopt them into Buddhism. But he'd always use his discernment, you know, not just willy-nilly, but this is what this aspect of what Buddha said, his teaching was a vibhajavadin. He taught a doctrine of analysis. Yeah, so to be able to say, well, what exactly, you know, I'm not going to either reject or accept things because they're, but I'm going to look at them and see, well, is this useful and is this good? So you know, Buddhist teachings can be used and is used both in good ways and bad ways in that kind of context. But just to come back to that first thing, I think it's a bit of a false dichotomy to say that you have to choose the Buddha or Freud. Freud was basically interested in curing certain kinds of you know, mental problems and psychological problems. The Buddha never really talked about those kinds of psychological problems. And there's nothing in the suttas that addresses, really, the kinds of problems which Freud addressed. And I think to apply Buddhist techniques to people with those kinds of mental problems is a very dicey thing, because Buddhist meditation techniques and so on are meant for people who have enough awareness and discernment to be able to do them. Yeah? Whereas people who have schizophrenia or other kinds of psychological problems don't, and they shouldn't be. And so they can be useful therapeutically sometimes, but that's something that needs to be very carefully tested. So for example, I mean, as a generalization, often say for schizophrenic type problems, meditation is very much counterindicated, because you'll basically just sit in meditation and start hearing all the voices even louder and clearer. Yeah? Whereas, say, for anxiety problems and depression problems, then meditation can be very good. So there needs, again, that's the kind of discernment that needs to be there. But Freud himself said that he was basically, the outcome, what he was looking for, was everyday neurosis. That's the best we can do. Yeah? So he was really interested in just healing sick minds and bringing them to a sort of ordinary kind of state. Whereas the Buddha more or less was assuming that people, most of the time, that people's minds were reasonably healthy and so on to start with, and then taking them up to the next level.
That was the starting point.
Exactly. Exactly. So when you're a graduate from Freud, then you go and enroll with the Buddha College. Yeah.
Maybe at times I have very limited understanding, extremely limited understanding of psychology.
Yeah.
But from some parts, often like outlining the issues, but not not necessarily giving a clear-cut path that's going to lead you beyond, you know, those issues and a path to liberation.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
yeah.
And sort of the way I've often interpreted it, the way the Buddha taught was, he's like, well, here's the issues, you know, here's how to get over them and attain nirvana, you know. And, I guess, like I said, my view is limited in psychology, but I always saw sort of it was quite limited to outlining the problems, but not necessarily giving direction how to get, you know, get a hold of them.
Well, no, I think the difference is more that psychology has outlines more limited problems. So psychology is not the Buddhism is, I think, is ultimately an existential teaching, in the sense that it's about what is the very nature of existence itself, what is the very nature of the life itself, and it addresses those questions of ultimate meaning, and psychology doesn't. Yeah, I mean, some of the psychologists will move towards that. So, say Jung, for example, he's sort of more moving towards that existential dimension. But generally speaking, psychology is more, you know, most of the way that psychology is actually practiced is just getting people to actually work, you know, getting them to function, getting them to not be so depressed that they're going to kill themselves, getting them to be not so confused that they can't recognize people around them, you know? So actually getting people into a normal fit state where they can have relationships and go to work and cope with daily life. What they do once they're there, for the most part, once you're able to do those things, then the psychologist will say, well, I'm finished with you, you know? You can hold down a job, you can have a relationship, you can have friends, and you can do those things. Therefore, you're okay, you know? So that's when, from a Buddhist point of view, that's when we say, well, now you can start to do some meditation and really go somewhere. Yeah.
So, I'm going to set it up. The Buddha never did talk about mental illness.
Not really.
Yeah, so what can be done? Because it has to be meditation.
In some cases, yeah. In some medication has its uses, and especially, you know, to stop people from killing themselves and all these kinds of things. In some cases, things have, certain kinds of conditions have very physical causes. Other times they don't. They can't be just reduced to physical causes. It really just depends. But I do think it's important as Buddhists, to have that kind of humility to realize that Buddhist teachings are not going to be necessarily useful in those kinds of cases. They might be in some cases, but we have to be very careful and use that discernment.
Can you also set it up, people with meditation?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
But I've also heard some different opinions of people who are whose minds are very active, yet depressed.
Yeah.
And maybe they need to do some physical active to start off with.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. If someone has any kind of problem which is really at that clinical level, then they need specialist attention, you know, ideally, to help. So when you say when I say meditation is good for people with depression, that doesn't necessarily mean that somebody who's suffering from very serious depression should just roll up at a meditation class and do what everyone else is doing. So, for example, in England, they did a comparative study of people with depression, particular kind of depression, and some of them had pills, some of them had what they call CBTs, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is basically samasankappa, right thought, and then some of them they did mindfulness-based treatments, John Kabat-Zinn's approach, and they found that the ones who had the mindfulness-based treatments was both by far the most effective and also by far the cheapest. Which kind of got the drug companies a little bit worried. And so that's now the preferred treatment for depression under the NHS in England. But that, of course, that's a specific diagnosis of a specific kind of depression, and it's a specific treatment with a meditative and mindfulness training which is geared for people with that kind of depression and taught by people who are specialists in that. Okay, so it's not just sort of generally doing meditation. So whenever it happens, and it happens to me quite often, that people come with various kinds of conditions, and then if it seems to me that their problems are not just ordinary moods and so on, but they do have that clinical level problem, then I'll always recommend that they go to find a suitable psychologist or someone who can help them.
I think that's quite comforting because it's not a lot of sort of religions, you know, that would recommend that in the end, you know. It's sort of like, it's nice that Buddhism, you know, can be sort of as a common sense thing, you know, that sometimes it can go beyond, you know, sit and meditate and everything will be fine. Recognizing the merits in.
And also, you know, doing that, it's given me a lot more respect for people who do that kind of work, who do that kind of therapy. And it's one of the, I mean, you can imagine, I mean, we've all met mad people. You can imagine how hard it is to spend your life is to sit there with mad people and to try to make them better, you know? It's most difficult and thing, and the most compassionate thing that you can do with your life, just about, you know. So I've really got a lot of respect for people who do that, and they're so little you can do. That's the reality.
I'd say even you know, having people close to you who have recurring mental health issues, is quite draining for you. So that's for your job, where it's a constant thing. All day, every day. Another story.
You've met my friends, and you've met my friend Terrence, and you worked in that field. There's a life for 2 years before burning out himself.
Right. And again, I think this is why a lot of the therapists are looking to Buddhism and so on, to provide their own kind of spiritual nourishment that can actually help them to keep going.
Especially towards the end, there were some days that was just so easy. Very overwhelming.
So you made reference in your blog this week about Jack Kornfield and how he was saying that that even stream interest may need therapy. And how would he have arrived at he's at the forefront of the, you know, the Buddhist monk who's got into the psychotherapy field, and he's sort of world famous.
That's fine. But look, Jack Kornfield, I mean, he's just a teacher. I don't know him, and I haven't really read his books and things like that. But I know that he does say these kinds of things. Why and what's going on? I mean, I'll be honest. Why does he say those things? Because I think. Jack's primary background is from the Mahasi Vipassana system. The Mahasi Vipassana system is very forward in telling people that you become a stream enterer when you do your retreats. So you go along, you do a retreat and so on. You can read, for example, the biography of Sayadaw Pandita, and he sort of says quite openly, you know, after a whatever it is, 3 month retreat, 50% or something of people have attained stream entry and so on. I don't agree with that, and I think that most of these kinds of attainments which people are told that they have are just cases of overestimation. And I think that the nature of the Mahasi Vipassana system has been to encourage that sort of culture of overestimation. And so what I think has happened is that there are a lot of people walking around who have been told that they're stream enterers and they're not. And these people have various kinds of psychological issues. And there was a book called Saints and Psychopaths written a while ago, which had various cases like this. Like one person was like mentally retarded stream enterer, and so on, and so various kinds of things. And I just think they're not. Yeah.
Because they're not stream
enterers. And they quite probably are in need of therapy. And I'm not. If they need therapy, terrific. Great if they need that. But the idea that a stream enterer is in need.
What to make of it all? Good, that's clarified.
Is there any way of knowing it somewhere?
I don't ask questions about that.
Well, the Buddha said that you can judge someone if you're at the same spiritual level as them or higher. Okay, so if you become a stream enterer or maybe an arahant would be even better, then you can judge the others. But until you're there yourself, probably best to be a bit cautious.
That's not a checklist.
The problem with these things is that there would be falsifying behaviors, but there's nothing that you can really tell that would make it certain. So, for example, if you saw someone who's a drunkard or a drug addict or something like that, you say, well, obviously they're not a stream enterer. But on the other hand, there may be someone whose, you know, behavior is very good and they're very wise and they're very compassionate, and so they, you know, but are they a stream enterer or not? It's very hard to say.
You know, when they're an enterer?
The person themselves would know. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They might not. They're still a, what the immediate thing that a person would know. They would know the experience. The actual thing that happens is unmistakable. They might not know what it's called. They might not know what the implications of it are. But they know that something's happened, and they know that something's changed.
Mm.
And particularly, it's been described like as a certain part of you is missing. Like a certain part of you which you probably even weren't aware of before is suddenly not there anymore. And so these are certain defilements which you're holding on to, and they're just gone. And so the process of actually understanding what that means is then a process. It's a process of reflection. In Pali they call pachavekana. And so that's something would then be assimilated for a period of time by the stream enterer afterwards, as they gradually kind of came to terms with actually what that meant for them, and what the implications of that experience were. And that may be different for that process may be different for different people, depending, for example, how much scriptural knowledge you have. Somebody who had a strong scriptural knowledge would be able to understand the implications of it much more than somebody who had very little. Or, for example, if you're able to talk about it with a good teacher or something like that would help.
So is it like a moment, or is it a gradual thing, or is it a...
Well, this is another one of those huge controversies in Buddhism, but basically it's a gradual practice, but it's a sudden realization. According to the suttas, it's like a flash of lightning in a dark night. Yeah. So that the moment of realization is sudden, but again, as I said, the assimilation and reflection on that takes a period of time afterwards.
Is that a moment that is over time, the impact of it can be subtle, but then you can have other little moments and subtle moments and
That realization of that insight is not going to be present to your mind at all times. Okay, sometimes you'll forget about it, and especially for a stream enterer, they're not perfect. Their mindfulness is not perfect. But so you know, your mind can still get defilements in it and so on. But what will never change is that those particular things which have gone, they've gone forever. So those particular fetters. Attachment to identity view and attachment to precepts and practices and the doubt, they're simply absent, and they're forever absent no matter what happens. But your state of reflecting about their absence and understanding their absence and what their implications are, that's something which will change. Yeah.
So it's not possible for that person to really commit a major wrongdoing even as an expert.
Yeah, I don't think so, yeah. We actually had a bit of a discussion about that this week with Pia Tan in Singapore. But traditionally it's held that a stream enterer can't consciously break any of the five precepts. So, and that's...
They can't because they just don't have capacity to do that.
Right, yeah. Whether that's literally true or not, I mean, I think that precepts have grey areas, so it's a bit difficult to say that 100%, but certainly pretty much that's the case. A stream enterer wouldn't break a precept, and that would also be the case in future lives. See, so those defilements wouldn't be present if they got reborn, but they wouldn't know the difference, which is the interesting thing, because that's just how they were since they were a baby. So until that understanding came back to them and they were able to reflect on it, they probably wouldn't understand why other people acted in different ways, why people acted in such stupid ways and such harmful ways, because they didn't have those defilements themselves.
So what happens in the last rebirth then? Seventh rebirth, is that?
In maximum seven rebirths, yeah.
So they don't have to do anything?
No, they can just slack off. That's what the Buddha said. He said, I didn't teach this teaching about maximum of seven rebirths because for exactly that reason. Because then all the stream enterers would just slack off.
But would that be easier then somehow, narratively?
What?
Just reach that state and...
And then slack off. Yes, since then it would be easier.
Yeah. We're all going for stream entry.
Okay, just kind of going back to when you said that you would be reaching the stream entry level.
There's
a part of you that disappeared, that maybe department. Is it usually a unpleasant or pleasant?
Oh, pleasant.
Experience?
Very much pleasant, yeah. You see, it's like this. It's like a weight lifts, which you didn't know the weight was there, and or like the mind comes to a sense of normalcy. It was previously twisted out of shape. There was a force in the mind. You know, think about it that way. That there's a force in the mind which is twisting it out of shape. It's always been twisting it out of shape, and so you didn't even realize that it was out of shape. And then that's gone, and the mind comes back much closer towards its natural shape.
So an intuitive person that would have a teacher or that would understand the path, compared to a person who felt this way and just by mere accident and somehow trying to find an idea of what happened to them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you'd do it by mere accident, but you might certainly do it by, practicing with a lot of... See, they have two kinds of stream entries, the Saddhanusari and Dhammanusari. Dhammanusari goes through practice of wisdom and inquiry. Saddhanusari goes through faith. So somebody who might have a very strong faith, they still have some understanding, but the faith is very strong. And so then when they realize this kind of thing, they'll know what's happened, but they won't necessarily really understand what it means so easily.
Can that be the same for a person who have an experience of a life-threatening experience and they somehow come across that and they realize something's missing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like I'm just trying to compare, I don't know if you guys have read the Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that in the beginning of the book, just mentioned that you reach this level where the focal point was kind of suicidal. It was just trying to explain his experience at that moment.
Yeah.
It's a comparison to what you're.
Yeah, no. Certainly, it's a very similar kind of thing. You know, there's this idea of the fetters. So, like, the fetters are things which tie us up to suffering. And so, when you let go of the fetters, that whole kind of mass of suffering just lets go. It lets go because we no longer identify with it. So this is the trick, is that actually our past suffering, our past acts and so on which cause us suffering, it doesn't do that intrinsically, it does that because we identify with it, because we think it's ours. So we actually have to, it's actually our own energy and our own force which actually brings that suffering into us. And so when stream entry, we abandon a sense of identity view, so we no longer identify with that stuff, and we just let it go. So this is why, the Buddha said that, He said the suffering that a stream enterer has is like seven little pebbles, and the suffering which he's let go of is like the mighty Himalayas. Yeah? So that's just that seven lifetimes is all that's left. So I'm conscious that we're getting pretty late, so we should probably finish up. Before we go, are there any announcements anyone wants to make?
From the first
to
April.
Okay, starting on April Fool's Day, that's good. Yeah. April Fool's Day. It's an April Fool's retreat.
And also, a lot of you might know that the Mitra conference will be held on the 1st and 2nd of May. And the early bird discount has actually been extended, but unfortunately it's been extended only until tonight.
Ah, right, so rush back.
Register. We have renowned speakers including Tetsin Palmer, Ajahn Brahm will also be here, the Gregory Kramer, and Bhikkhuni Dhammananda, who's the pioneer in women's Buddhist issues. And on that note, just the night before the conference, which is the 30th of April, there's going to be a snack here with Bhante Sujata. In fact, we also have the privilege of guest speaker, who's Venerable Dukten Chodron Prophet Stress. Some of you might have actually heard of her. She's, I think, one of the Western nuns in the Tibetan tradition who managed to set up her own nunnery. So she'll be a guest speaker here, along with a Mahayana monk, who's also a Chinese Buddhist scholar. So there's going to be Bhante Sujato, Dukten Chodron, and Venerable Huifeng on the 30th of April. That's a Friday night, just before the conference.
So that should be fun, yeah. That's good. And the other things that are coming up, and we don't have... We'll give you the details for this later, but we're putting on a talk by Ajahn Brahm that will be just after the Mitra Conference, so either on the Monday or Tuesday after the Mitra Conference, and we're just organising the venue for that. So we'll give you the details for that when that's finalised. And then later on in May, we're also having a philosophy night, which is on the evolution of happiness or the growth of happiness. So that will be myself, a psychologist, a biologist, and a philosopher. Okay, so talking about the growth of happiness from four different perspectives. So we'll give you more information about those things. That's in Sydney. That's at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts in Pitt Street. Yeah, the other one in the Blue Mountains is another one. Again. Blackie. I'm not sure of the details. You can contact me if you want the details. That's on the moral philosophy of Buddha and Nietzsche.
Buddha and
Nietzsche. Yeah.
Cool.
That's me and Justine. Okay. Let's finish my paper.